Sunday Night Saffron, a babble about religion, politics, and all things ethnic, with John Saffron and Father Bob Maguire.
Good evening, dear listeners. Good evening, Father Bob Maguire.
Good evening, John Saffron.
Lots of battling authority tonight. We're going to be talking to a female soldier about what happens to your head when you go over and fight, and then come back, and how do you shake all those things out of your head. We're also going to be talking to a man who was part of on the receiving end of a nightclub raid that happened in Melbourne a few years ago, where it was implied that maybe they were only raided because it was a gay club, and he was one of the people in the club, and he's going to tell us what's it like.
I remember that.
Can you ever trust authority again if they pull that one on you? And you'll also meet one of the Central Park Five. Now, here's a clip from a trailer about the Central Park Five.
New York in the late 1980s was a completely schizophrenic, divided city.
New York's now the capital of racial violence.
If I had more bullets, I would have shot them all again and again.
Criminality, gang wars, drug wars. We were supposed to be afraid. It would have been irrational not to be afraid.
Off with the camera, man!
Last night, a woman jogger was found unconscious and partially clothed in Central Park. She was beaten and sexually assaulted.
A woman jogging in Central Park. Central Park was holy. It was the crime of the century.
Five youths were arrested at 96th Street, all between 14 and 15 years of age.
They got them!
You can only imagine the pressure to have this crime solved, and solved quickly.
First we was all together, then they started to put us in different rooms separately.
What did you do? Who were you with? Who did you come with?
The tone was very scary. I felt like they might take us to the back of the precinct and kill us.
You're not going to go home until you give up a story.
I told my son, go to the park that night. I feel guilty.
I'm telling the guy, I don't know what you're talking about. They're getting a little angry.
And they're like, you know, you did it.
Four black kids and one Latino kid were arrested and charged for raping and beating a white jogger. And then years later, their conviction was vacated. So we're going to be talking to one of those five were boys, now men, about what's it like to be thrown in jail for, I think, 14 years.
Yes.
And then have your conviction vacated.
Which is a term.
Raymond Santana is the man we will be talking to. And we'll also be talking to Sarah Burns, who investigated this crime and co-directed a documentary on them.
Sunday Night Saffron. Triple J.
Father Bob Maguire.
Yes.
You know, I don't ask our listeners much. So, dear listener, I'm really talking to you, not Father Bob. Bob, you can go back to sleep.
Thank you.
But I have this thing, because I believe in everything has this reason and this purpose and this destiny, and that often helps. Like, something happens, like, oh, I've got to chase after that dream because I was meant to do it. But there's this other thing that sometimes when thing goes wrong, I think it's like a message from the gods or the universe trying to tell me something. It can get me quite anxious. And one of the things that happens is if I drop a plate or a glass in my kitchen, because I live alone in this little flat, and just say it's like 11 o'clock at night and it's quite dark and I'm there alone, and I'm no doubt half drunk because I've just been watching True Detective, drinking gin or whatever, and then I go to the sink to get a plate so I can like put on a biscuit on it or something like that, and then it crashes into 1,000 pieces and I just see these shards everywhere, and I get like, rather than just like, oh, you know, stuff
I
like
dropped
that.
A plate.
Yeah, drop the plate. Like, what does that? I think it has this
meaning.
I get quite anxious about it, and it has all this meaning. And I've got these plates that are like my grandparents' old set.
Oh, don't say
so
that.
So I'm thinking like it's released some dibooks and spirits into the flat. I get really. Then I was thinking, my problem is because I'm always alone when that happens, and everyone's always alone when they drop a plate, usually, unless they're in a family or whatever. So we don't know that everyone else is dropping plates all the time. So I'm kind of like indulgently thinking that somehow the universe is sending me a message, when really
the plate's dropping everywhere.
Yeah, like it's a Greek wedding.
Yes, yes.
So, dear listener, can you – my tweet address is at John Safran, or if you want to send me a letter, it's P.O. Box 196, Balaclava 3183. And just get in contact with me if you drop a plate or a glass.
Ever?
Yeah, ever. Like, so just like my phone will buzz during the day, bzz, and I look at it and go, and, you know, it'll be Sarah, and she's dropped the plate. I go, oh, okay, like that. And then in my head, I'll start, like, calming down and being less self-indulgent and just going, this is part of the process of the universe, John. Don't get so stressed when you drop a plate.
Oh, that's nice. It's aversion therapy.
Yeah, because I've noticed, like, bitter, indulgent people, often that's the thing that makes them bitter and not being able to get on positively in the world.
Oh, I see,
John. Is they don't have this connection that we all have struggles and we all have pain and we all have rejection and we all have hurt and all those things. And they're always like, meh, 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 meh. Like, we've all got a family member like that, surely.
Indeed. Yes. They're everywhere.
So I've just seen this in other people. I don't want to become that person who doesn't see that there's a universalness.
Yes.
To struggle and blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
And so, yeah. So just, yeah, basically tweet me or send a letter to P.O. Box 196, Balaclava 3183.
Yeah, Victoria.
And just tell me when you drop a plate or a glass.
Get an app. Makes shattering plate noises. At will.
Sure.
You know? So I'll ring you up if I drop a plate. What are you dropping plates for?
Hang on, you're doing the opposite of what
I
said.
Oh, sorry, I'm making
yes.
Yeah. But especially grandparents' plates. That's a terrible thing.
And they've got little stamps on the bottom.
Oh, don't say that.
They probably carried them on their back from Poland.
John.
On a boat.
John.
Whilst my mama was sort of...
Was it
a basket on her head?
No, let's get off it. Stop it.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Tonight, we're looking at people who have been thrown against authority and how they've come out the other end. Have you ever had a brush with authority? Jump onto Twitter, at John Safran, or at Father Bob, and let us know. Soon you'll meet a lawyer who unexpectedly found himself in a police raid. Plus, what does it feel like to be a soldier? Now take a listen to this, dear listeners.
When you first get back, the smell of shampoo or the scent of perfume on a woman's skin just floors you. You just stand in the street and breathe it in. Out of patrol, you might not wash for a couple of weeks. Sweating like a pig all day, you don't change your clothes. One day and the next just blur into one another. There's a lot of time, but there aren't any days. Every step you take could be your last. You push the fear down, way down. You learn how to live with it.
That's a soldier performing in The Long Way Home, a play touring nationally with real soldiers sharing their personal experiences from the line of duty. You'll meet Sergeant Sarah Webster soon.
This is Sunday Night Safran on Triple J with me, Bob Maguire, and John Safran. And joining us right now from the US of A is Sarah Burns. She's the author of The Central Park Five, a chronicle of a city a-wilding. And one of the doco makers behind the Central Park Five. Also joining us is Raymond Santana. He was only a teenager when his conviction was vacated.
No, he was a teenager when he was convicted.
Oh, sorry, he was wrongly convicted.
With four other teenagers of the rape of a jogger. And then much later on, his conviction was vacated.
Yes,
and they're both joining us from New York. Hello, Sarah. Hello, Raymond.
Hey, how you doing?
How are you?
Good. Well, I guess, is there a simple way to explain what the reality was at the time? Like, what did people think had happened in 1989? And then we'll move on to how the facts were reinterpreted later. So maybe, Sarah, can you give us a little summary?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated story, but the basic version is that in April of 1989... a white woman, an investment banker, was jogging in Central Park in New York City, and she was raped and beaten and left for dead. And the police focused their investigation on a group of teenagers who'd been in the park that night and very quickly decided that they must be guilty of this crime and interrogated them. And ultimately, those really intense interrogations over many hours, days even, with, you know, no food and no water and no lawyers, led to some of these teenagers giving incriminating statements. And once that happened, it was sort of case closed. The city was at a time when crime rates were really high and people were very fearful. And so the fact that these Black and Latino teenagers had been in the park and it looked like they'd given confessions, people didn't really ask any questions about it, even though the statements they gave were incorrect on the details of the crime. And there were huge problems with this case, but no one really cared.
Now, Raymond, you were one of those teenagers. And can you tell us and tell the listeners what happened in 2002, which was, so the first thing happened in 1989, and then now we're moving to 2002.
Well, what happened was that a serial rapist and murderer by the name of Matias Reyes, he happened to bump into Corey Wise, who was in his 13th and a half year of this case, and he was in prison at the time, and they engaged in dialogue. Now, Reyes never told Corey that he was the original perpetrator of this crime. All he did was he engaged in dialogue, and he got a feel for Corey. And from that conversation, you know, he felt like it was his, you know, he had to do something about it. He felt, you know, that he had to come forward because this man was spending all his time in prison for something that he didn't do. And Reyes, at that time, he became very spiritual, and he went and told the chaplain, and that was the first person who expressed what happened. And they went up the ladder from there. So in 2002, we filed the motion to vacate the convictions.
What does that expression mean, vacating? That means you're exonerated and you're absolutely definitely not guilty? Or does it just mean something like, oh, hang on, there's not enough evidence as we first thought so? Or what does vacating the conviction mean?
Well, it means that all charges were dropped against us, and the state never pursued to recharge us or to retry us because they felt that we were innocent. It wasn't just that Mateus came forward, but like Sarah said, there was many inconsistencies in the statements, the physical evidence, the DNA evidence. You know, they took our handprints, our feet prints, they took our clothes, they took hair samples, they took blood samples, and nothing never matched the Jaga.
An unusual thing about this case is that the victim, Trisha Melly, that she was so traumatized by the event that she had no memory, so she couldn't bring a position on who her attackers were after the attack. Is that right, Sarah?
She actually had a traumatic brain injury. Matias Reyes beat her so badly in the head that she had a brain injury. And so it's really a miracle that she survived at all. They expected her to die when they brought her to the hospital. And the fact that she came out of a coma and walked and talked and everything is pretty miraculous. But she never formed any memories from that night because of the brain injury. And so she was never able to identify what had happened. She had no memories from several hours before she was attacked.
And what did she think about the 2002 vacation of the convictions? Has she come out and said anything?
You know, she hasn't really commented much on it. She wrote a book that came out in 2003 about her recovery and actually really revealing her identity for the first time. Before that, she had been anonymous, as the press generally treats rape victims with this privacy, and she was known as the Central Park Jogger. And in 2003, she revealed her identity and described her recovery. But she's really focused on that, on how she came back from this traumatic brain injury.
And did you try to reach out for her, either when researching your book or your documentary?
Did. Yes, I did when working on the book and for the film again. And she politely declined to participate. I think for that reason, you know, she's focused on how she recovered and has kind of chosen not to be involved in this conversation about the wrongful convictions at all.
And when you pressed record on the camera for the first time for the documentary, were you like, these five now young men are definitely innocent, or were you still willing to go where the documentary took you and where the interviews took you?
You know, I'd been researching the case for many, many years because I'd been working on the book. But I think I came at it initially, you know, when I first started researching the book and first learned of the case, the convictions had already been vacated. And so I kind of approached it rather than from the perspective of having a set view on whether they did it or not, but just to kind of, now we have all this information and looking at it. And it became clear to me very quickly that there's no way that these guys had anything to do with the rape. And so by the time we started working on the film, I don't think we had a lot of questions about that. But certainly we were prepared to sort of go where the story took us. But, you know, having studied it for many years and looked at the facts, and I mean, I read 15,000 pages of trial transcripts in my research, among many other things. And that was very clear to me.
And Raymond, when did you become involved in Sarah's projects? Was that when the book was being written, or was that only when the documentary started getting made?
No, well, we met Sarah in 2002, I believe. She was an intern at our attorney's office, Jonathan Moore, at the time. And you know, she was, you know, that was the first time that, you know, she really heard about the case, and she just wanted to do research paper on the media presence in our case and how they portrayed us. And that was the first time we met her. But during her research and her reading all these transcripts, she finally got to the truth. And she became outraged, and she wanted to do something else, and she came back and she proposed the book. But this was a woman who was on her way to law school, and she put law school on hold so that she could fight this injustice. And that was a great thing.
And is it, when you're filming a documentary, I've filmed documentaries myself, that it can get, I don't know, not strange, or it can get weird, because people can be innocent of the crimes, but they can have, you know, like negative qualities or unattractive qualities, and deciding as a filmmaker, oh, are you going to show all the sides of the person, or are you just going to edit things, you know, that back up, sort of like trying to present people in a certain way? Did you find that hard, Sarah, or was this like an activism documentary where, you know, like things that did not present the five young men in a good light weren't going to make it?
No, I mean, I wouldn't call it activism in that sense. I think that we were interested in getting to the truth of this case and telling the story that had never been told properly before. Everyone had always gotten it wrong. And so it felt like it deserved a proper telling. And also it gave us this opportunity to talk to the five and to hear their story in their own words. And that was a really important part of it, giving them an opportunity to speak. You know, the other side of this had plenty of opportunity to speak about this. And we certainly approached them as well. They chose not to speak to us, but we tried to hear from everybody who was involved. But I think, you know, that honestly wasn't really a struggle for us. I mean, I think that we tried to talk to everyone, and we talked to the five, and we're very grateful that they all were willing to share their stories with us. I think they would have every right to be skeptical of the media, considering what they went through in 1989 and 90. But, you know, the only thing that really was a little bit complicated about that was the fact that, you know, there was this large group of teenagers, many more than five, who were in the park that night, and some of them were committing other crimes. Certainly nothing along the lines of this rape, but harassing and in some cases assaulting joggers and bicyclists in the park. And so there was always this, we had to be careful to not not show that part of the story, that this stuff happened, that some people in this group were responsible for these crimes, and to not pretend that that didn't happen. But also, let's make a very important distinction between being accused of a rape and sent to prison for that, and what these men may or may not have been involved in, these other things. And there's no evidence that any of the five were actually involved in these other incidents in the park.
And the prosecution, they wanted you to hand over all the footage that you'd shot in this documentary?
Yeah, actually, the city of New York, so the Central Park Five filed a lawsuit in 2003, a year after the convictions were vacated, against the city for the wrongful convictions. And the civil lawyers for the city who are defending that lawsuit served us with a subpoena demanding that we turn over everything, all of our interviews. And, you know, here in New York State and in the U.S., we have laws that protect journalists from that sort of intrusions into our process. And so we decided to fight it, really on principle. I mean, it wasn't so much an issue of the materials that we needed to protect as much as it was the fact that it's not our job to do research for the city of New York's lawyers. And so we fought that and we won in court. A judge agreed that we were journalists and we were protected by the shield laws for journalists and did not have to turn over our materials.
Because some of the prosecution, I understand, don't accept this vacation or this exoneration. They say, well, this may prove that this other man had DNA on the jogger, but that doesn't mean some of the others weren't also involved. That's their position, isn't it?
Yeah, there are still some people who make that argument. Some of the people involved in the original case, the prosecutors and police. And, you know, honestly, coming from this perspective that I did, which was the convictions have been vacated, the evidence is all out here, and you can look at it now with all of the pieces intact. I think that gives me a better perspective, and many other people who agree, than someone who was invested in a certain version of this story from the beginning, from before all that evidence was available, and who quite honestly jumped to conclusions about what had happened. And I think that, you know, there's plenty of academic studies that show that people, when confronted with evidence that contradicts a belief they have, rather than changing their belief, they dismiss the evidence. And I think that's what's happening here.
Now, Raymond, when something as awful as this happens to you, is do you just spend all your days thinking of what could have been, like what could have been if I wasn't in jail for, I think it was 14 years, or does your head just adjust around it and kind of go, well, that was a part of my life for those years and that's affected me in some ways and there was obviously lots of negativity to it, but it just kind of is what it is and I'm moving on?
I think it's both. I think at the end of the day, you know, what we went through is something that would never leave us. And so you always battle with that possibility of, well, if this didn't happen to me, what would I have become? But it's hard to think about that because that is gone. Those years are gone. We cannot get them back. So, you know, for us now that we're grown men, you know, we're approaching 40, you know, at this stage in our lives and we have families. And so you have to say, all right, well, how can I turn this around and create and make something positive out of it? And this is what we have been able to do. Yeah.
And so so telling the story through documentaries and through books, that kind of gives meaning in some ways to all the awfulness that happened before.
Well, it also, you know, it has given us a platform that now we can go out. At first, when people see the film, they realize that we were kids and now we're grown men. And so it gives us a level of connection. You know, now people get to see us on this platform and they get to see us human beings. And it has given us a chance to go and go around the country and talk to numerous kids and tell them the message of the Central Park Five. Because what we started to find out as we got older was that this happens all the time. And so, you know, you go to Chicago, there's a Central Park Five there. You go to Virginia, there's one there. So it happens all across the country. And this is something that we want to prevent. So we decided to invest into the kids by telling the story, and hopefully we can save some lives in the process.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Raymond. The book is called The Central Park Five, A Chronicle of a City Wilding, and the documentary is called The Central Park Five. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran. I am John Safran, not Foa, and with me is Father Bob Maguire, not Ted.
No.
Still to come on the show tonight, you'll find out what it feels like to be a soldier.
Nothing's changed. I haven't changed.
I have. When I look in the mirror, do you know what I see? Nothing. Because that's all I'm good for now. My war's over, I know that. I'm not going back to Afghan.
Is that what you want to do?
I can fight. I'm good at it. Is anyone going to pay me to fight? It's what I can do. Good for nothing else. I'm useless.
Nick.
I can't be what I used to be. I am my job. Now there's no job.
But there's here, there's home. You're home now.
When I was in Afghan, I had to forget about you and home. I had to forget about it, so I did.
That's a scene from the play The Long Way Home, which is touring the country right now with real-life soldiers acting out the scenes. You'll meet one of these soldiers soon. Stay tuned for Sergeant Sarah Webster.
You're listening to Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Father Bob.
Yes.
Now, you don't follow me on social media, do you? I want to show you a picture I posted this week, because you just spend all your time Googling yourself, don't you?
Yes.
Here we go.
No, I follow you.
Look at this picture. Look at that picture there.
That picture there, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, there's a baby.
It's a baby. And what's the baby doing? The baby is lying down, dear
Sleepies.
Listener. Sleeping. And next to it
is an iPad.
With the Sunday Night Saffron.
Yeah, Sunday Night Saffron with you in a dark ninja type.
The father of this baby
suit.
Says that he plays the podcast.
Oh, and he pushes the button.
Next to the baby. Oh. And it helps lull the baby to sleep. Anyway, so I thought for this baby, we'd do a talk break. Like just for...
What, as babies or what?
No, not as... Well, what? Anyway, Serpil, just hit the sting again.
Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Hey, Father Bob.
Hello, John. How are you?
I was reading Mr. Men books. What's your favourite Mr. Men book?
I don't
Worry.
I can't read yet. I'm only a little baby. No.
I don't think we have to be babies ourselves. It's not like when High Five or the Wiggles come out, they're babies themselves.
I see what you mean.
We just have to talk.
Oh, you excited me then, because I was slipping gradually back into baby.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, it was lovely. Thank you so much for that. But what
do you remember being a baby, Bobby?
Not much, darling, no. Now I can remember, no. Did I fall out of the bassinet? No, we never had a bassinet. We were too poor. So I think... No, I don't remember much.
Do you know what my first memory was as a child? My first memory in my whole life.
You're making
it up. No, I'm not. Mm. My first memory in my whole life is I took this pack of cigarettes from my mummy's dressing room's table, and then I went out to the backyard, and it was like a lemon tree. I sat by the lemon tree.
Chewing the cigarette.
And I chewed on the cigarettes, and it was such a harsh sensation.
Oh, yes.
It like rot. It got in my... And that's my first memory in real life. Hey, listeners, you might be having your first memory in real life right now, very soon. So keep up with it. What books did you read? Did your mummy and daddy or whoever, goddamn, read when you were a baby, Bobby?
Mine? No, we were too poor.
Too poor for books.
All we did was lift up the lino on the kitchen floor and reread the newspaper that was under the lino. From 1838 or something, or the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. See, that's how poor we were.
And your toys? What toys did you have?
Oh, no, we didn't have any toys. All we could do is play with our toes. That's all, don't you? Because we're good pious Catholics as well. You can't be, you know what I mean?
Don't use words like
no,
pious.
No, none of that.
The kids don't like the words
no,
pious.
No, they don't like pious.
Well, they don't know the word pious.
So they won't know the word pious.
No.
No, so that's what we did, yes. I remember the one-eyed...
What?
Teddy bear.
Oh, that would have been scary, yes.
No, I think that we might have found it in the dump while we were scavenging for food.
Sure.
Because we're very poor, you know. So what did you have? Did you have one-eyed teddy bear? You would have had a black-faced gollywog, wouldn't you?
No, I wasn't like doing race irony when I was 3 years old. It wasn't like... Hey, Mum, I heard the gollywog's been banned from Noddy. I ironically would like one. It wasn't like that at all. No, I didn't have a gollywog when I was a baby. I'm trying to think anything like flavorably Jewish that happened because the audience would like that. I think I had a dreidel. You know what
a
dreidel?
And what prey is a dreidel?
Well, you as the supporter of the casino who
excuse me. I blessed the casino.
I exorcised the casino. Despite the fact that Tim Costello, a more moral minister.
Don't go back there.
Sorry. Anyway, a dreidel, you spin it, and depending on which Hebrew letter it lands on, it's like a spinning top with four sides, depends how much chocolate Hanukkah gelt you get.
Truly.
It's like chocolate coins. But don't... Listen, don't make any...
What, a lottery or something?
Well, it's not like a lottery. And they're chocolate coins, okay? And it's not like to train us
no,
to be
no,
sort
no,
of like
no,
to like money
there.
Or
That's
anything
awful.
Like that.
That's awful. Don't go there. Listen, by the way, what brand was this? Were the cigarettes?
You're not allowed, no Serples flapping about in the other room saying,
"Oh, you're not allowed to talk."
We're certainly
cigarettes.
Not allowed. We're not allowed to mention products on ABC. If we are going to mention a product, the worst product you could mention is a cigarette.
Sorry.
Do you know? Speaking of cigarettes, actually,
don't talk about cigarettes.
Okay, no. For speaking of cigarettes, in the last episode of True Detective, where I was sitting there on my couch sipping on my cordial.
And drinking.
Yeah, cordial.
Smoking.
No smoking.
Oh, sorry.
If it, just jelly beans and cordial, that in the key scene, one of the main characters gives the other character a gift and he opens it up and it's a certain brand of cigarettes we've seen in earlier episodes. So it's like this, not only is this subtle product placement, I feel like we've moved on from what a baby would be interested in now. Now we've just moved on into usual saffron. Blah, 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 blah. Join the dots, man. Join the dots.
But that baby, how is the baby now?
The baby's
how long has the baby been exposed to your...
I don't know. I wasn't told. I was just sent the picture of the baby with the podcast. Anyway, baby of Chris, I hope you enjoyed this special talk break. It was just for you. Do you want to sing a little song for
a
the kiddie?
A little song, yes.
Go sing a song for the kid.
What'll I sing? God, I can't remember a baby song. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. What a bloody fool. Babies. Yeah, there you are.
How's You're that? Listening?
Did the Humpty Dumpty did fall off the wall, I think. Yes, that's all right.
You're listening to the ABC 3 version of Triple J.
Yeah, infantile radio.
Stick around, you'll hear about the police raid of a gay club years ago, and one of the people in the club at the time, he then went off on to help with a documentary on the subject. Here's a grab from the doco, The Tasty Bust Reunion.
We informed everyone entering the venue that the information that we knew, some people, 400 and so people still went in and partied. And the rest is history.
This is a raid. Lights, where are the lights?
Quiet.
Hands on your head. Stop that music. Hands to the wall. Quiet.
That was a snippet from the doco, The Tasty Bus Reunion, which is going to screen at this year's Melbourne Queer Film Festival, which is on until the 24th of March. Have you ever had a brush with authority? Send us a tweet and let us know. At John Safran, at Father Bob, or at Soypool, our producer, S to the O to the I to the P to the L. You're listening to Sunday Night Safran on Triple J with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire.
Sunday Night Safran
on Triple J.
Father Bob.
I was in Cairns on Thursday night. Last week.
The film festival, Cairns.
No, Cairns. Cairns.
Mm.
The cyclone city.
Yes, go on.
Go on. You're supposed to say, geez, well, how'd you get back?
How'd you get...
No, I didn't get... What? I went by Skype.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that doesn't sound so interesting. It's 80 years of age. Mm. I worked it out.
How did you do
I
Skype?
I would go, not only... But they're in the watching the film in Bob We Trust. They're all sitting there in the theatre. And at the end of it, what happens?
Mm.
I'm on the big screen talking to them as if I was there in the flesh.
Yeah.
Question and answer. Now, I reckon that's an achievement.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you'd say, oh, well, you've got to be there. No, you don't.
Now, I mentioned before, dear listeners, about please tweet me if you drop a plate or a glass so I can be in this universal brotherhood of people who break stuff and not feel isolated and alienated and alone. There's something else I'd like you to tweet me. If you see me down the street and I'm wearing something that you don't like, I'd prefer to hear about it. Because I don't want to express my rebellion in my clothes. And I spoke last week about how, unbeknownst to me, I was breaking all fashion rules by wearing a red cloth Dickie belt.
Mm.
And a woman came up to me and told me she couldn't stop looking at it. Because she could... How can you be such a fool to think you can wear this 1990s Avril Lavigne skater boy red belt on a pair of black jeans in 2014? Anyway, she wasn't mad because I brought it up with some other people during the week.
And she was right.
Well, another friend of mine said, yeah, you've got to get rid of that belt. Like saying she's always wanted to tell me about the red Dickie belt and how I just should not be going around in 2014 wearing a red Dickie belt with a pair of black jeans. And then she made a comment about the jeans. She thought they were a bit loose. But what I'm getting at is I want to express my rebellion, my individuality. I want my troublemaking through, like, books or documentary or something like that. I don't want to be like, I'm trying to, you know, challenge the system by wearing, you know, rebel clothes or anything like that. So if you see me and you think, and don't be like my friend who was clearly judging me on my belt for years and then didn't say nothing. Don't be like that. Just tell me straight away. And then I'll kind of, what's the word? Calibrate.
Calibrate is good.
I'll calibrate my wardrobe so it's totally normal.
Will you? Yes. You don't want to be known to be avant-garde?
No, not in my clothes. No, I just want to be neat. The most I'll go avant-garde is my gun bracelet. That's it. I'm not getting rid of the gun bracelet.
What happened to the ring? What happened to the ring?
I'll even drop the ring if you want me. I've got this mounted boar's head on a ring. Yeah.
Intimidating, you know.
Yeah. I'm agnostic about the ring, right? Mm. But this is staying, my gun bracelet.
I didn't know that. I mean, imagine a woman coming up on the street and saying, excuse me, but, I mean, isn't that offensive behaviour?
No, not to me. Not to me. Because I'm not, like, emotionally invested in my clothes. So I'd much prefer to just have neat, normal clothes and looking, you know.
But like, how do you know the woman knows better than you know?
Trust me, like, as soon as I reckon she's right about the red Dickie belt.
Well, how was she dressed? Did you give her a dressing down?
No, she was dressed not nicely and normally. Well done, Meg, on your nice and normal clothes.
She might have had, green eyes, tattooed eyes or whatever they call it. Injected in her. You didn't notice that?
Yeah. Be very careful about getting caught up in the fashion of the moment, dear listeners. Like, because what will happen? Like, Chris Scadden, who runs Triple J, got caught up with the whole Red Hot Chili Peppers thing. And he's got two sleeves that go all halfway up his hand and it says Blood Sugar written on the left arm and then Sex Magic on the right arm. And on all Triple J meetings, he now has to roll up a bit of, because he doesn't want everyone to see them, so he kind of like pulls up the sleeves of his shirt now because he got caught up in, you know, Big Day Out 94 or whatever. So just don't do that.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Because you can think something. Do you know people were going around with cat's eyes about 10 years ago? Oh, I'll just wear cat's eyes because the Prodigy wear cat's eyes. This will never go out of fashion. Why don't I get long-term cat's eyes? I'll never live to regret this. Just watch it, kids.
What, green eyes?
You can always take off a red Dickie belt. But you can't take out your permanent cat's eyes or get rid of your blood sugar sex magic sleeve tattoos. You're listening to Sunday Night Safran. I'm John Safran. That is Father Bob Maguire. Later on, we'll find out what it feels like to be a soldier.
This is Sunday Night Safran. Joining us right now is film and entertainment lawyer Sean Miller, who features in the doco, The Tasty Bust, A Reunion, which is showing as part of this year's Melbourne Queer Film Festival.
Bob, why are you outing Sean on radio?
It says here.
Okay, just fine, okay.
I'm just reading the thing. What are you talking about?
Sorry
about that.
Better blatant than latent.
Ah, yeah, fair enough.
What did I say then?
I'm winding you up, Bob.
Oh, thank you.
Sean.
Hi, John.
Lawyer.
Good to see you. You're looking well. You've got a body that men fear and women crave. It's really wonderful.
Can you confirm that I have lost weight?
You have, but you're not wearing a beard with a little pony, Bob. You know all these people walking around North Fitzroy? Yeah. They look like Ned Kelly ballerinas or something. And you're not doing that. You haven't succumbed to that. Because in about 10 years' time, we're going to look back on that like we look back on people in the 70s wearing flares. The kids of tomorrow are going to say, you look so daggy there with your beard and pony, Bob.
I feel like this interview's already gone off track a little bit.
It has. It's always the
Now, can you tell us about the tasty nightclub raid?
Okay. There was a nightclub in the city called The Tasty.
In the city of Melbourne.
In the city of Melbourne, in the CBD, called The Tasty Club. Now, although you referred to it as a gay nightclub, it was really just a nightclub for the misfits of Melbourne. which maybe gay people fell into, but so did transgender people and straight people who wanted something a little bit more bohemian and alternative and out there. And on August the 7th, 1994, the nightclub was raided by a few dozen police officers who supposedly had a warrant, although more on that in a moment. The police were supposedly looking for drugs. The DJ put the smoke machine on, and anyone who might have had something in their pocket that wasn't quite kosher, they threw on the floor. And then the police proceeded to strip search all 463 people in the club, as in you had to take your shirt off, your pants off, your underpants off.
And it wasn't
performance art, it was the real deal.
But that was odd. There aren't other examples of them going into clubs and making
They didn't go into other clubs in the early to mid-90s looking for drugs or, King Street in Melbourne, there might be a bit of a drug trade.
But they didn't
there.
Go to the Melbourne Club.
They didn't go to the Melbourne Club. They didn't go to the Lyceum Club. No, they went to their sort of established crusty men's and women's club. No, they went to the Tasty Nightclub. And after the raid, this was in the days before people had iPhones and text messaging and Facebook and all of that. But people could still do things before those things came in. I mean, you've got to realise, the world did manage to do things before Facebook.
Thanks, Grandpa.
Yeah. That's okay. I'm a bit of a granddaddy here. And so a group of people got together, got on the media. Yours truly was one of them. And then a legal action was established against the Victoria Police. And it went through the courts, and the police were found to have overstepped their authority and power, and they were acting, the legal term I think is ultra vires, which means beyond their powers.
Ultra vires.
You see, I know Latin. John, just relax. And what happened was people were compensated to the tune of about $12,000 each.
$12,000 large?
Yeah, which in 1994 was
that's 12
even
large.
More,
12,000
bananas, yeah. And which in those the, 20 years ago was a fair bit of money.
So what was going on? Like what?
What was the motive?
Yes.
Well, you've got to remember that in the early 90s, when a lot of your listeners were just being born probably, but in the early 90s, the Victoria Police Force was getting a bit gun-happy and trigger-happy. There were more killings, inadvertently, admittedly, by the Victoria Police in Victoria, in their line of duty, than the rest of Australia put together. And Jeff Kennett, when he came to power in 1992...
A premier.
The premier of Victoria. He came in and he was closing down a lot of schools and other things in order to save money. And basically, the whole state was for sale, including its soul.
Yeah, so how does this tie to them raiding
because,
a gay nightclub?
I'll tell you. Because for example, the Richmond Secondary School, which is in inner city Melbourne, was being closed. And do you remember the police? There was a huge altercation between the police and protesters at the time. So there was a bit of an undercurrent where the police might have felt they were being sort of put upon by the public who were blowing back against the police. So there was tension in the community. And I don't know ultimately what the police motive was to go into a gay nightclub looking for drugs, because they could have gone into any nightclub, and even if they found some drugs there, it would have made any one iota of a difference to any drug problem or otherwise in the state. I mean, what was the point?
So they'll just get maybe... Do you reckon sometimes with these things it's like individual people, so that there could be individual cops who were just overexcited for some reason? They wanted to be dramatic, or there could have been some homophobes or whatever their issues
were. I mean,
you've
got to remember, and this is well before your dear audience members were born, but homosexuality was only decriminalised in Victoria in 1981. In New South Wales, it was 1984. The last state to decriminalise homosexuality was Tasmania in 1997, which isn't that long ago in the scheme of things. So if it was decriminalised, homosexuality was decriminalised in Victoria in 1981, there would have been people in the police force, senior, in the 1990s, who entered the police force in the 1960s and 70s when, you know, police were, you know, were very, were, you know, homosexuality was criminalised, and police were actually authorised to go out and gang up on gay people. So that was the culture.
Yeah.
And there was a, you know, it's interesting because at the time, I don't know if it's changed, but it was the Victoria Police Force, not the Victoria Police Service. Now, there's a hell of a difference. I think police should be there to serve the community, not force the community around. What do you think, Father
Well,
Bob?
Well, around Australia, some of them are called police services, aren't they?
Yeah. But well, others not in are Victoria. Called police forces. And I think the word force...
And the uniforms themselves now changing from pale blue, which was friendly, allegedly...
To a dark
Into that, what you're calling
Yeah,
put on,
a
that
very dark navy blue. But, dark. I mean, if you've got a police force, it's like, well... You know, the police should be there to serve and protect, not to force their authority on minority groups.
And then what happens after the raid? Did you feel like you could trust the police again? Like, did it shake you up, or were you able to, like, put it aside as, well, there was this anomaly that happened and it has no...
I think a lot of it had to do with the police culture and police management. Now, you can't stereotype and tar every police officer with the raid. And also there would have even been some police officers conducting the raid in the strip searching who probably thought, God, I'm being asked to do this and this is all very strange. But it all happened so quickly and momentarily.
Was there
a
complaint?
It was only later.
No complaint?
At the time.
Yeah,
well,
that's what
the police had
they
guns.
Sued, and they got 12 lives.
No, at the time of the raid. And interestingly, people who weren't at the raid said afterwards that if they were there, they would have complained. But isn't it interesting that none of the 463 people who were strip searched did complain because they were intimidated. We were asked to put our hands against the wall. The police had guns. There was a history in the recent years of the police being trigger happy.
Yes.
But
so,
also,
you know,
isn't
it's only on reflection in the cold, hard light of day that you can suddenly say, well, if this, you know, I should have done this, I should have done that. But legal action was brought against the police, complaints to the ombudsman, all of those sort of things.
It's interesting you say about no one saying anything because another side of that is... People, if you're not part of a group, so maybe if you're white, or if you're not part of a group that's often the police are hassling you, then you can think if the police are hassling you or someone, there must be a reason. And it's really hard. Like your brain's
not
adjusted that the police can do something wrong. There was, I remember there was this guy who was handcuffed. This was a couple of years ago in a couple of flats up from mine. And he's like on the ground and there's this plainclothes person. You're like, rah, rah, and he's pushing him or whatever. And I was so... Because the guy wasn't a cop. If he was in a uniform, I reckon I would have gone,
How did you know he wasn't a cop?
Well, I didn't know. I kind of... And I said
weird.
To him...
Yeah.
And it took so much guts. Like, I was really nervous. And I'm like, I'm fine for going blackface and getting crucified, right? It took me so much gulping to kind of go... can I please see a badge? But I did. I finally did. I did it, and he showed me his badge. But then I didn't do anything. But that shows how kind of scared you can be.
Intimidating.
Yeah, and how much you assume they must be in the right.
Use the word intimidating because when we were getting the legal action together, a group was formed. Can I just blow my own trumpet? I thought of the name called COPIT, and COPIT stood for. What did COPIT stand for?
I mean, it's fine, but I reckon if you Googled it, you'd find that idea had
been
done before.
Intimidatory tactics. It was something, I forget what the C stood for.
I get it. It was like...
Culprits or something of police intimidatory tactics.
Yeah. COPIT.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's okay.
That's what happened. And I think, you know, slowly after that, interestingly, the Premier, Jeff Kennett, who I mentioned before, he got onto radio after the raid happened and it was all in the media. And he said, I find this remarkable. So even this sort of very, at the time, you know, conservative Premier, even who was always very supportive of the police helping close down the Richmond Secondary School and the rest of Victoria, even he came out in favour of... well, maybe not the gay community, but certainly against the police action by calling it remarkable. And you know,
now if you you can have one question, Bob. No, I have a question.
I mean, you're saying, was there discernible trauma?
Look,
amongst those people, 200 and well, since, have you heard stories since?
Yes, I've heard people that some people in the raid were very traumatised and maybe are still feeling the effects of that. I have to admit, I wasn't that I was shocked, I was surprised, I was intimidated, but I didn't have any ongoing sort of post-traumatic stress syndrome or anything like that. Mm. But others may well have, yeah.
The Tasty Bust Reunion is showing, a documentary about this case, is showing at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, which is on until the 24th of March. Thank you very much for joining us, Sean Miller. And still to come tonight, we'll find out what it feels like to be a soldier.
When my last tour was almost up, I kept imagining all the things that would happen when I got home again. I kept you out of my mind, but then I'd let you back in again. I kept trying to imagine what it'd be like the first time I touched you again. And I touched you and just felt numb.
That's a scene from the play The Long Way Home, which is a play touring the country at the moment with real-life soldiers. Stay tuned to meet Sergeant Sarah Webster.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Hey, Father Bob.
Yes.
Someone sent us a song this week.
Oh, specifically for us.
He's an Austrian gentleman. Mm. His name's Sturgen. He's Austrian, but he lives in the UK at the moment. Anyway, I think he can explain his song better than us.
Welcome everyone to the Monday Evening Bathroom Sessions. This week's song is based on a radio show I listened to called Sunday Night Safran on Triple J. And yesterday's guest was Paul Verhoeven. And I took some of their dialogue and turned it into a song. You can listen to the actual dialogue at the very end of this video. So I hope you enjoy. Yes, I am a nerd, yes, but I don't think wrestling is, I didn't, yeah, it is, man, it's a big word, subculture kills, like, typically when I'm asked what wrestling is, it's, yes, I am a nerd, yes, but I don't think wrestling is, yeah, I didn't, yeah, yes, man. Imagine if right pantomime changed on villains who wanted out too much. Martial arts movies and angry furniture says men all had like a sexy baby, basically. It's this weird hybrid sports. Yes, I'm a nerd, yes, but I don't think wrestling is, yeah, I didn't, yeah, yes, man, yes, I'm a nerd, yes, but I don't think wrestling is, yeah, I didn't, yeah. Yes, I'm a nerd, yes, but I don't think wrestling is a yeah, dance. Yeah, it is man.
Yeah, so I am a nerd.
Yes,
but I don't think wrestling is.
It
is, man. It's a big nerd subculture because, like, typically when I'm asked what wrestling is, it's, imagine if, like, pantomime, James Bond villains who monologue too much, martial arts movies, and angry furniture salesmen all had, like, a sexy baby. Basically, it's this weird hybrid sport.
Sunday Night Safran.
With John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Thanks, Sturgen, for your
Yes,
I am a nerd song. That's pretty cool if you had someone following you around and then what sentences you say.
Oh, beautiful.
They come back to you the next week and make your sentences into a song.
Well, that baby is going to be a star because that baby's going to start talking like you.
Did I ever tell you about the game console that nearly tore up community radio?
No.
I once worked, this is years ago, at this community radio station, and I was on air, and, you know, I talk about my life, and I mentioned, and community radio, like, very poor. Like, everyone's very thin and shabby, and there's no money to, like, scrape the vomit off the carpet.
No. And anyway, the batteries are driven by pedals.
I'm on the radio and I'm giving some shtick. I'm going, anyway, so I was going to the shopping centre and I was thinking of buying this Nintendo. But then I decided, like, like that. Then, and I was in a team that did the breakfast show. Then a few days later, this package arrives from Nintendo, from the game console people. And they'd heard me, or, you know, their media monitors had heard me, and they'd sent me a game console of this thing. And then, because it was very, so suddenly into this very poor, destitute environment where we had to scrape by on our $25 wage a week came this expensive game console. And then it was like, what happens? Like, because, and one of my co-hosts, she had a kid. So it's like, do I give it to her because she's got a kid?
Mm.
Or do I keep it because they sent it to me and I kind of want it?
Yes.
And then on top of that, on Media Watch at the time, there was all this stuff about John Laws getting cash for comment. So it became this whole other thing of, because it was kind of like weird because I hadn't deliberately tried to procure this game console. But here it had come because I'd mentioned it on air on a community radio. So I didn't know what to do. And then the only thing I could think of, so I sent it to that canteen, that teenage cancer thing or whatever, because that was it. But you know what? It was never the same between me and the co-host who had the kid, because I reckon she thought, come on, John, after all we've been through,
yes,
I reckon you should have handballed that to me so I could have given it to my kid, because I was the one in the team with the kid. It was never the same. And that shows how wealth kind of makes everyone greedy and tears everything apart. I once saw this film about someone winning lotto and then like how the whole community falls apart because that person won lotto and everyone becomes savage.
Yes, the love of money is the root of all evil.
It was like that.
God, how do you get through a day? Isn't it?
This would never happen to us now because...
Oh, we're beyond and above and beyond it.
Well, you'd just take home anything.
Oh, anything at all. Anything at all.
Sunday Night Safran. Triple J.
Dear listeners, you're listening to Sunday Night Safran. I am John Safran. That is Father Bob Maguire. And joining us from Wollongong, she's gone from the theatre of war to the theatre of theatre, Sergeant Sarah Webster. And she's part of The Long Way Home, which is a theatre production, the personal stories of Australian servicemen and women who have been wounded, injured or become ill during Australian Defence Force operations in Iraq, Afghanistan and East Timor. Thank you for joining us, Sergeant Sarah Webster.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Bob.
Now, before you were a soldier, what was your, like, preconception of soldiers? Like, what was, like, floating around your head growing up about, I guess, soldiers in general and maybe, you know, Australian soldiers and the Anzacs and stuff?
I grew up in a military town. I grew up in Townsville, so I was fairly well surrounded by soldiers and the military for most of my life. However, growing up there, I was very adamant that I didn't want anything to do with the military because the people I met I thought were quite arrogant and rude and, you know, they were generally quite the boys' club. And then when I was at university, I got a bit bored, decided, you know, I'm in a military town, I'll join the reserves. And that's when my perception of military changed a lot. But once you're in that environment, you work with some really, really great people who you make some really good friends with. You realise that it's an environment of camaraderie and friendship and things like that. It's a very enjoyable workplace most of the time.
When you say arrogant and rude, so you weren't there like thinking, oh, politically I disagree with this or anything like that. It was just more a bit like, oh, they want to keep separate from me. It was more on that kind of more basic level.
Yeah, it was more than that sort of thing. You know, I was at university. I'd go to the university club on a Thursday night and there'll be the army boys there. And I was just like, oh, I don't really like those sort of people and that sort of thing. And that was the perception I got from them. I had no idea of their background or what they did for work or anything like that. So I just had a very social opinion of them and nothing more.
I wonder if growing up in that town had such a huge impact on this other level. Like, because I've read things about how when you grow up and, like, the smells of the food your ethnic grandmother cooks kind of, like, goes into your nostrils and it becomes, like, part of you, you can never escape, and then you love all these things that are around you when you're very young. And it seems like if you're growing up in a military town and you're seeing all those medals and the uniforms, there'd be a, it might be something that's sort of weirdly comforting when you get a bit older, like because it's part of you as a child.
I think I agree with that in the sense you sort of, without realising, get drawn into that without ever even realising it's part of your subconscious. It's something that's always been around you, something you're always familiar with, but you just don't always identify with it on that level where you actually realise it's actually part of your life without it really being so on a level you actually associate it with.
And you which was the first war you went off to?
Iraq in 2006.
And what was sort of going on in your mind and I guess the minds of people around you when you went off to that war? Because it was kind of like a bit of this ambiguous thing of like, did you know, like people supported the soldiers and everything, but was there really a visceral thing in the community of like, oh, this is definitely a war, we have to go off and fight? And so how did that affect you?
When I went to Iraq, there wasn't still a lot of people within the Australian Defence Force going to war. We had people in East Timor for quite a long time, but that was more of a peacekeeping, peace enforcing mission. So when we went to Iraq, it was something that Australia hadn't done for quite a long time. It was actually going into, you know, a proper theatre of war, not to take anything away from Timor, but at the time this was actually a place that was truly a war zone. And we didn't really know what to expect. It's not something that had happened in Australia for quite a long time. So when we went there, it was more of an air of anticipation and excitement to sort of know that we were getting to go and do the job we'd trained for such a long time. And we sort of went with no expectations or any sort of idea of what we were sort of walking into other than taking our training into a theatre that we'd learnt for and we'd trained for. The opinion of the Australian public and that sort of thing doesn't really come into what we do. We get trained for a job and we join the military to do this job, so that's what we go and do.
The you mentioned East Timor versus Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's kind of interesting because I guess a lot of people would think, oh, the reason there's so much support for, you know, for East Timor and everyone can get behind that is because it's a peacekeeping thing, but it's probably more than that. It's because there's this sort of like whole backstory of our bond and our history with the East Timorese, you know, going back in time. And so probably even if it wasn't a peacekeeping mission, it was the Australian people could sort of like get more behind that. But doesn't that get into the soldiers' heads? Don't they have a feeling of which of the conflicts that the people are really feeling a part of back home and which of the conflicts that are more, you know, well, in theory, we should be here because we have to do what we're told and we've been told to do this.
That last part of what you said is we go where we're told and we do the job that we go to do. We go there to support the men and women that stand there beside us and are there to actually assist in the job that we're there to do, whether it be peacekeeping, peace enforcing, training another army so that they can become in control of their countries, or whether we're there to actually create political stabilisation. We go there without any preconceived connotation what the political side of things are. We go there to do a job, and that's all there is to it.
I like being involved in things that are far lower stakes than going to a conflict. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing when you work on a little project with a lot of other people. My stuff got nothing to do with this. It is pretty easy to kind of get involved and like come up with a reality in your head where what you're doing is meaningful and purposeful. So I can totally understand how, regardless of where someone was put, it'd be easy to get into that reality. But then of course bad things happen with injuries. Can you take us through that?
When you go into any environment, we have people injured in the field here in Australia. We have workplace injuries just like any other job. And then we go to places where there are a greater potential for things to go wrong and for people to get killed and wounded. And that is something that we just take on as part of our job. We don't necessarily expect it to happen. We certainly don't want it to happen. But it's something that is part of what we do. It's certainly a more high-risk job than, you know, the everyday job that most people in Australia actually have.
And what about you personally?
I was injured in Iraq in 2006. When we had indirect fire come into the compound where we stayed, where we lived.
And what happened though?
So a rocket attack hit a concrete T-wall outside of the bedroom that I was sleeping in.
Wow. And is it, does nothing prepare you for that? Because like you can kind of like think of what, you know, like in theory, if you go to war, stuff like that will happen, but it just kind of totally jars you?
Not really. In our circumstance, we'd had indirect fire from the day that we'd arrived in Baghdad. So it was something that we'd kind of grown used to. It was something that was part of our normal day, you know, rockets and bombs came in, and you did what you could to prepare yourself for it. And, you know, we'd already sort of had these discussions that one day this is probably going to hit us, and once it does, we'll deal with it at the time. And we were pretty lucky that I was the only person who was actually seriously injured in that blast, and we were very, very lucky at that time because the amount of damage that was done to our compound was actually quite significant. So I suppose you can look at it from that regard that, yes, bad things do happen, but you can also look at the fact that what happened to us specifically was actually quite lucky for the outcome that we had.
You'll have to explain, Sarah, I think, the difference between indirect fire and direct fire.
So indirect fire, so the rocket that hit us was, they assume, was fired from 5 kilometres outside of the green zone from where we were staying. So it wasn't something that was fired directly at us. Basically what happens is they let off a certain number of rockets, and if the people that let them off hit something, then they'd had a good day and we'd had a bad day. Whereas direct fire was, you know, on a one-to-one sort of contact. So this was not a contact, as in we weren't fighting an enemy directly at that time.
Now, was that when you were injured, and that would be one of the most important turning points in your, not only your career, but your life?
It certainly has made a very big difference in my life, and it certainly makes you well aware of a lot of things that go on around you and how other people see the world and what other people are living with every day as well. So that certainly opened your eyes up to a world you may not have been aware of before that.
And do you become like part of a club where you feel like you feel like people who haven't been in that precise situation, like they just can never relate to it, and you actually feel a bit of a bond to people who have been in that rare situation?
In a way, yes, and that's where the group of us who are part of the Played a Long Way Home have come together. But when I first got injured back in 2006, we hadn't had a lot of people injured in any of our war zones, so I was sort of one of very few back then. And then since we've spent a lot more time in Afghanistan, we've spent a lot more troops in Afghanistan, that club, for want of a better word, has risen to about 300 people, some who are no longer in the Defence Force and some who are still trying to stay in, and some who are being discharged. And I'm lucky enough in the fact that through the Wounded, Injured and Ill programs within the Australian Defence Force, I've met a few people through different adventures, and the Long Way Home is one of those. And we are a very close-knit group of people because we have all been through things that are very similar and that a lot of people haven't experienced before.
And what just something that popped into my head, what do you think when you come back home and you see young people and they're playing video games that are all set in conflict and they're shooting things up? Is that do you find that tasteless, or do you find it
fine? Not really. That's just society. I mean, would someone who was in a car accident be concerned about someone playing Need for Speed or any of the games like that? That's just society. Most people who are playing those games aren't certainly sitting there thinking, well, you know, I'm the same as a soldier or I'm at war or anything like that. It's just, you know, it's just a game.
Sure. And this theatre production, why do you think it's important to tell stories these ways as opposed to just writing them down or talking to a journalist on a current affair show?
This play is talking to, or it's reaching out to a lot of people that, one, haven't got a lot to do with the Defence Force, but there are still a big number of people from general society who have no idea about what the Defence Force is doing or what its people go through during war, after war, or if they've been injured through work or through going overseas to war. And this is a way of reaching out to the greater community to let them know what our soldiers go through, and especially to a group of people that, especially theatre goers who have nothing to do with the military, who would not normally be in that environment or talk to those sort of people. It's also getting along people who are in the Defence Force or have associations with the Defence Force to sit down and watch this play and be able to look through scenes that might go on in their own homes that they wouldn't normally be able to talk about. And actually, the feedback we're getting from people who've seen the play is that some people, even from Vietnam, who've never sat down with their wives to have discussions about what they went through, are finally actually having those discussions.
The mixture of actors together with real soldiers who have been in a theatre of battle.
Yep.
Did somebody come up with that from inside the force, or was it the person who wrote the play? A mixture of people.
We actually stole this off the British military.
Ah.
2 years ago, the British guys got together with an independent theatre group and put a play together called The Two Worlds of Charlie F. And the commander of our Defence Force, CDF General Hurley, saw this play a couple of years ago and said, I want to bring that to Australia. So he spoke to a few theatre companies in Australia. The one that took the play on was Sydney Theatre Company, and then they got the director of the British play on board, Stephen Rain, and they came up with the idea of putting this play together, which was written by Daniel Keane.
And did it work immediately well, or did it take time, teething?
It took a lot of time. I'm pretty sure if you talk to 90% of the soldiers that are a part of this, which is the majority of the cast, when they were first told about this project, everyone's reaction was, I'm happy to help out, I'm happy to be part of it, but I'm not going on stage. Every person who signed up for it last year, who got through the workshop in late last year, is now on stage playing a part in this role, talking, acting, doing media things, things that most of these guys would not have had the confidence to do even 6 months ago.
And is General Healy in it, Hurley in it as well?
No, he's not in it. He just does a lot of advocating on our behalf.
What about the guy who screamed at us on the television last year? You know, that soldier who said, get out if you're not going to accept women in the army. Who was that guy?
I'm actually not sure who that is. I don't think I've actually seen that.
I think he's the chief of
Morrissey,
defense.
General Morrissey.
Yeah, so. He'd be great on in a theatre production, surely.
Idea behind this play was not to, you know, it was to get people who have been wounded, injured and ill through their service to defence and use this as part of their rehabilitation. All of these guys suffer from physical and psychological wounds, and the idea was to get them into an environment where they can start talking about those and start rehabilitating themselves, and hopefully to get them talking to their wives, family, friends about what they're going through, and for them to better open up and be able to actually start dealing with what they're going through. And that was the idea behind this play.
And this is playing all over Australia over the next couple of months. It opens at the Sydney Theatre, or it already has been there.
Yep, we've already been to Sydney, Darwin. We're currently in Wollongong. From here, we go to Townsville, Canberra, Melbourne, Adelaide and Perth. And there are still tickets available in all of those locations for those that are wanting to come and see it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Sergeant Sarah Webster.
And, thank you.
And dear listeners, you're listening to Triple J.
Sunday Night Saffron.
Triple J.
Father Bob. How come you never told me about the most interesting thing in the history of Australia? And indeed, how come no one has ever told me about the most interesting thing in the history of Australia?
Which is what?
Is that there was an Australian politician around the 30s, like a proper guy in Parliament, who was a killer and had killed two of his opponents, his political opponents.
No, I didn't know that.
And then he escaped to England and then killed someone else. Someone sent me this because they knew my interests in
killing.
Thomas John Lay, former New South Wales politician, who was convicted of murder, and they say he may have even killed more than the three. And this is from the Australian newspaper, by the way, just in case you think I got this from some conspiracy website.
Yes.
They wrote about this 4 years ago. The Yeah, do you want to ask me any questions?
I was going to ask you, did he kill his political opponents? Or are you saying just random killings?
No. He killed his opponents who were going to bring him down for corruption.
Oh, so he took it all deadly seriously.
Yeah, so the first guy he killed was his opposition in his seat, but it was after he'd won. He'd already won, but then he was worried... that he was going to be exposed for bribe. I think he bribed the other guy.
Oh, I see. Yes.
To lose or to not campaign or something. Yes. And then he was worried he was going to get caught out. So that's the first guy who went. And then there was some other person who wasn't a minister or wasn't in parliament but was involved in investigations. Yeah. And he was worried about him, so he killed
him
too.
Good night.
And three makes you a serial killer. So he was actually a serial killer. So thanks a lot for never telling me about the most interesting thing in the history of Australia, but boring me senseless with all the uninteresting things.
What's his name? Lay.
Lay.
Thank you.
The other thing that talking of politicians, I watch a Mitt Romney documentary this week called
Good
Mitt.
Good.
Yes.
Talk about boring. I mean, why do
I was really trying to be open-minded. Because,
I see what you mean.
And also he's a Mormon, so I was like, oh, this could be interesting or whatever. But I think, even though a Mormon makes him interesting, I think because he's been too rich for too long and the family's too rich, I think you have to have, scrapes and bruises. More scrapes and bruises than he has. There was something about the family that just was excruciating. Like, they weren't, you know.
Too pure. They didn't come.
His wife has got MS. I'm not saying, we don't know what's going on in their lives. I'm just saying, I was trying to analyse as to why this family is so uninteresting to watch in a documentary. And I think it's just things have really gone their way.
But the rich and powerful do play a big part, don't they, in American public life?
Mm, yes.
In this country, that is not necessarily true, is it?
No. The one thing that was kind of interesting about this doco was, you know, like people who are against the power elite, like if you talk about, they talk about them, it's always like, oh, so, you know, the Koch brothers fund and, you know, and there's all these machinations and puppet masters. Well, this whole documentary just seemed to show him, you know, like...
an ordinary, what, boring...
Well, you know, like he's a guy and he's got this ego, so he wants to help out and he thinks he can help and blah. And so there seemed to be like a real normal side to those in power. Like it's not all like their cartoon characters.
How do you think Mr. Obama is performing? I saw him on another comic show.
Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis.
What do you think? What do you think? He puts himself in risky positions, but he's beyond all that, I suppose. Now he can do what he likes in these last 6 months.
Because that's that argument that the way you get messages out these days is through other means besides appearing
If you wanted to, you'd appear on this show, for heaven's sake, to get your political message out with great clout, wouldn't you?
Yeah, if you're going...
I was interviewed by John Safran. I mean, what...
If you're going for, like, the lizard ruler-believing community, we do definitely have that demographic stitched up, people who believe our planet is run by lizards.
Well, faces in clouds. I haven't had much reaction to my faces in clouds.
Was that one of the things that didn't catch on, really?
It didn't catch on, really. One of several.
That's a bit like when those comedy shows where someone who's got lots of characters... they're really popular. They introduce one that just doesn't quite catch on.
No, mine don't seem to be catching on, unfortunately. The fag end of one's career.
There's The Chaser.
Yes.
ABC's The Chaser.
They got smacked.
They're in a legal scuffle with Chris Kenny, who's a journalist from the Australian newspaper.
Yes.
And
I didn't see it.
You didn't see it?
I didn't see it, but I heard.
Anyway, the Australian newspaper is going again, attacking the ABC, you know, trying to create this drama or whatever. And I was talking to someone this week, and they were telling me that what's happening is that, like, in Britain, there's this argument against the BBC there that the Murdoch papers have, and it kind of resonates. Like, people out there in the streets actually do feel like, oh, this is bullshit. Why do I have to pay my license fee for that? So it's worked so well in Britain that Murdoch's trying to bring that kind of blueprint over here.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've pointed out many times on the show, it's not working because research shows that conservative Australians, you know, blue collar Australians, or like classic, they just don't dislike the ABC. Rural Australians, everyone. So this whole thing of clonk.
Yes, no, not working.
It does remind me of, I once read this headline about Jennifer Aniston and all her flop movies, which was, you know, stop trying to make Jennifer Aniston happen. Like, stop putting her in movies. It's not happening. And I feel like that's happening with the Australian versus the ABC. Stop trying to make that there's this groundswell of Australians who hate the ABC happening because it's kind of not happening.
Mm.
Oh, well.
Somebody alerted me to the fact that he said what appeared to be white supremacist Australia.
What?
Young people walking around using the stars of the Southern Cross as the equivalent of an Aussie Swazi.
Yeah, what's
have
your question?
Have you got any information on that? The symbol is being used?
Yeah, well, it's a symbol. The Southern Cross is used by all sorts of people. It's used by people in unions.
Of course.
It's also used by left-wing people.
This is only the stars.
Oh, yeah, I don't know anything about that. Yeah, but people do complain that, like, some white nationalists in Australia have appropriated it. So, I've heard that before.
Tattooed it on their necks and things.
Oh, so is there a certain design that makes you know, in code?
That's what I'm suggesting to you, who are Australia's leading investigator of this phenomenon. But you're not...
No, it's gone, yes.
You're not saying anything that it's well known. No.
Not that I know.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I got that from Twitter.
Sunday Night Safran.
Triple J.
Father Bob.
You've been to the theatre? Have you been out this last week?
To the theatre?
To a play?
I haven't been to a play.
Haven't you?
Just slinking around the streets at night? Yeah, slinking.
What, indulging in your martial art?
No, I haven't done any Krav Maga this week. Did you hear with that the disappearing plane that they were saying if it was a terrorist act, it might have been the Uyghurs?
I saw the Chinese were suggesting that maybe it was your friends, the Uyghurs.
But the Uyghurs, dear listeners, is a group that, if you listen to Sunday Night Saffron, we were way ahead of the curve.
We were ahead of the curve.
Of introducing Australian public to this ethnic group called the Uyghurs who wanted to break away from China. So ahead of the curve were we that the Australian Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, came on the show years ago and I brought up the Uyghurs. He had not heard of the Uyghurs. It was like, that's how alternative, obscure
they
the Uyghurs
were. The days.
And now they're a group that may have... But someone who was an expert on the Uyghurs said this would be so upping the ante on what the Uyghurs usually do. The Uyghurs usually do just way lower key stuff. So let us not assume at all it's the Uyghurs.
Well, the Americans, I think, were suggesting that there was a young person on board from Iran, Iran is their particular bête noire.
So is everyone just bringing up whoever their enemy is and pretending that they're on the plane?
That would seem that way, but we've got to be careful not to be facetious in this matter, isn't it? Because everybody's upset.
Yeah.
And lots of players. Anyhow, be that as it may.
You'll be happy to know, Bob, I'm not going to be getting drunk every week. It played out.
Yes, I was a bit concerned. I did talk to the...
It played out the 8 episodes of True Detective. Gone. In which I got drunk every episode, but now it's over. But do you know there's a mystery that was solved at the end of True Detective? Because True Detective set in Louisiana. And what do you know? That other HBO show, Tremor, I think it's called, set in Louisiana. And, what do you know? True Blood, set in Louisiana. Mystery to solve. Why this great love of Louisiana?
Yes.
And it's a tax credit thing. Apparently Louisiana just introduced, or you know, a few years ago introduced this new thing where it's cheaper to film productions there than in California. So then suddenly
explains everything.
That's the mystery at the end of True Detective as to why all these shows.
Well, I'm glad it's over Louisiana. For you, because I was really almost at the stage of conscientiously having to consult the ABC, you know, team psychologist. As to whether one should approach you, like with regards to the red belt.
Yes.
And say, John, do you really think you may in fact be drinking too much?
Yeah, I realised it was too much because the last episode of True Detective, I didn't understand all the resolutions, what was going on. And I was like, maybe. And then I went on the internet and everyone else understood it. And it was just because I was drunk every week
that I didn't.
Yeah.
Don't say that. Anyway, we're going to wrap up.
Cool.
So let's thank the guests for tonight. Sarah Burns, author and doco maker behind the Central Park Five.
Raymond Santana, one of the actual Central Park Five.
And Sean Millard, lawyer and tasty nightclub victim.
Who Bob outed on radio. No, you didn't. I keep on winding you up.
Oh, go on.
And Sergeant Sarah Webster.
You can keep in touch with us via Twitters. Send us a tweet at Father Bob or at John Saffron. You can also tweet our producer at Soipel, S-O-I-P-L.
And tweet me particularly if you drop a plate.
Well, that's true, isn't it?
Or jump onto the Sunday Night Saffron Facebook page. And don't forget that the podcast will be up for you tomorrow morning. Grab it from triplej.net.au/saffron. Or go to iTunes or go to SoundCloud. Or just if you see me on the train, just come up to me and I'll give you the lowdown on what happened on the show really fast so you don't have to listen to the whole godforsaken thing.
Next up, stay tuned for Fenella Kernabone.
Hey, Fenella.
On Sound Lab. And that's all from us, ladies and gentlemen. Catch you next week, kiddies.
Particularly the Triple J baby.
Yes. Yeah.